caused me to stray from the land, far away from my friends and companions, to follow the Velvet Band.
This is Damon Blanchett, and you are listening to Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio. On this show, I talk science, news, skepticism, and play some music. Each week, I choose a different theme for the music I play, and this week, it's bands from Massachusetts. And since I started looking for bands from Massachusetts, I found there are far more that you would recognize than you might think. That one at the top was Black Velvet Band from Dropkick Murphys, who are originally out of Boston. You can tell they love that town if you actually listen to any of their music, really. They mention it quite a lot. They actually have a song with the name, The State of Massachusetts. But if you'd like to reach me anytime, you can do so nearly real time by sending me a tweet to @DamonBlanchett, or you can send me an email at damonblah@gmail.com. I just came over here from the RCC here at Hampshire, and I saw some clips of Ken Burns' new documentary, The Dust Bowl. He's actually here on campus. He introduced it. I got to see maybe about a half hour. He was just showing random clips from it. I guess it's a four-hour documentary all about the Dust Bowl, which was far greater of a disaster than I ever thought it was. I figured it was just a few years of not a lot of rain, a lot of dust, but it was actually one of the largest human-created environmental disasters in the history of America, and if not the world, probably the largest one in the history of America, and one of the biggest in the entire world. Can't wait to see the full documentary. It's going to be premiering next month on PBS, I think around the 17th or 18th. I'm excited to check it out. I've always kind of been interested a little bit in the Dust Bowl, especially after seeing there was an HBO show called Carnival, which aired maybe 8 or 9 years ago. Fantastic. Actually takes place in the Dust Bowl during that time period, 1930s. So moving on, My unsound method of the week comes to us all the way from Italy. On Monday, six Italian scientists and one government official were convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 6 years in prison. What was their crime, you might wonder? They were accused of providing, and I quote, inaccurate, incomplete, and contradictory, end quote, information that was also, quote, falsely reassuring statement, end quote, about the tremors and subsequent earthquake that struck L'Aquila, Italy on April 6th, 2009, 3 years ago. So it seems they've been on trial for this entire time. I remember hearing about this a couple of years ago, in fact, that they were going to be tried, but the actual conviction happened on Monday, or maybe yesterday. I think it was Monday. They're also barred from ever holding public office again in Italy. They will, of course, appeal, which is, from what the article I read, is required in Italy. You have to do an appeal before a sentence is carried out. If the appeal doesn't work, if it's struck down, then they'll automatically be brought to jail for the next 6 years. Whether they win the appeal or not, the case will definitely destroy, if it hasn't already, the lives of these six scientists and one government official. Of course, and rightly so, scientists all over the world are alarmed at the outcome of this case. It sets a really dangerous precedent when it comes to science reporting, and the public. People have said it will deter experts from sharing their valuable knowledge because they're going to be afraid of getting prosecuted. My personal opinion on all this is that it's just complete insanity. I just don't understand this. It's impossible to predict an earthquake, from everything from when it will occur exactly to how long it will last to how powerful it's going to be. That seems to be the problem that the Italian court system had with the statements by these scientists, is that they didn't think it was going to be that bad. They said, this earthquake's not going to be bad, don't worry, and it ended up being pretty bad. People died. But it's impossible to predict something like that. Listening to tremors and small movements of the ground will allow a certain amount of predictive power, and that's what these scientists did. All they were doing was the normal thing that scientists do, or at least earth scientists who are following earthquakes. They can watch some seismic activity, they see a bunch of tremors, and they have to think, well, is there going to be an earthquake? Is there not going to be? Will it be a big earthquake if there is one? But there's still, at least now in the year 2012, no way to know whether the tremors will end up being nothing or a huge earthquake. I got a quote from the BBC's science correspondent, and I quote, "The Apennines, the belt of mountains that runs down through the center of Italy, is riddled with faults, and the eagle city of L'Aquila has been hammered time and time again by earthquakes. Its glorious old buildings have had to be patched up and rebuilt on numerous occasions. Sadly, the issue is not if, but when the next tremor will occur in L'Aquila. But it is simply not possible to be precise about the timing of future events. Science does not possess that power. The best it can do is talk in terms of risk and of probabilities, the likelihood that an event of a certain magnitude might occur at some point in the future." End quote. Really, in the end, what this case really highlights to me is the importance of science education all over the world. I think if people understood more about how science works, and just the fact that there's nothing, you can't be absolutely certain about anything at all. All science can do is make predictions, but there's no way to be absolutely certain, and especially when it comes to things like earthquakes or tornadoes or hurricanes. There's no way to know how hard it's going to be. We can do a little bit better with things like hurricanes and storms because we've got pretty powerful radar and you can see the hurricane. We have satellites in the sky, but when it comes to earthquakes, you can't put a camera underground. You're going to see blackness. There's no way to know. All you can do is go by tremors, little shakes, things like that. I mean, if you go back to, say, Mount St. Helens, it wasn't an earthquake. It was of course, a volcano eruption, but there were tremors before that, and people knew it was going to erupt. They felt you could feel the tremors. You could see smoke coming out, but they had no idea that half the mountain was going to be destroyed and the amount of damage that it caused. There's just no way. Science can tell you a little bit. It can give you maybe a warning, but there's no way to know. Nobody can predict the future. At least with much accuracy, that is. So, the Italian courts get my nod for unsound method of the week this week. All right, I'm going to do another song here. This one comes from a Massachusetts band called the Pixies, who are also, like Dropkick Murphys, originally from Boston. Here's their song, Where Is My Mind?, which is something I often wonder. That was Where Is My Mind by the Pixies, another band from Boston. Actually, the next song is from another Boston band, but that's okay. It's a big city. My second story this week is a bit more on the light side compared to that last one. Comes from newly published research in the journal Current Biology. It turns out whales, that's right, those huge mammals that swim through the oceans, can speak human. Or, well, at least they can mimic some of the sounds that humans make. Very much like parrots can. Maybe not as well, but like parrots. Marine biologist Sam Ridgway at the National Marine Mammal Foundation in San Diego says he believes that NOC, I believe it is, a beluga whale, learned to imitate humans by listening to them speak underwater and at the surface over the course of years. This actually happened back in the 1980s. Originally, that's when NOC was alive. This is, in fact, not the first observation of whales mimicking humans. In the 1940s, it was reported that scientists heard wild belugas making sounds similar to, quote, children shouting in the distance. A few decades later, at the Vancouver Aquarium, keepers said a beluga whale there spoke one of their names, which was Lagosi. They could actually hear the whale saying, Lagosi. The scientists who published the paper are careful to say that while the whale's sounds are not as good a mimic as of human voices as other animals such as parrots, I guess there can't be too many animals that can mimic human sounds, but parrots are always one of the big ones. It's still an example of vocal learning, nonetheless. Quote from the paper, and I quote, "It seems likely that NOC's close association with humans played a role in how often he employed his human voice, as well as in its quality." And for your listening pleasure, I actually have an audio sample of the of NOC's voice. And I gotta say, it does sound pretty, it's kind of creepy actually, but here you go. Here's an example on the website I found of NOC's speaking. Hopefully this will work. It's just on my computer. That was it. That was a beluga whale. And it sounded, to me, it sounded like, I don't know, like a baby or something. Very weird, but that's what it was. Does sound very human-like. Pretty weird. I had no idea whales could do that. It's such a huge animal, too, beluga whale. I actually saw one, I think it was not this summer, but last summer, 2011, I went to Mystic Aquarium down in Connecticut and heard, or didn't hear, but I saw beluga whales swimming around. Amazing creatures. It's not easy for a whale to make these sounds. Their air passages are definitely not exactly the same as a human's. According to the scientists, NOC's calls are several octaves lower than a normal whale's. So they're usually much higher pitched, like whistles. This allowed him to make sounds of a much similar pitch to humans. Ridgway's team managed to get NOC to speak on command and found that he makes the noises by increasing the air pressure in his nasal cavities. A little bit different from humans. They think he then modifies the sounds by modifying the shape of small structures that sit above each nasal cavity. So he does it with his nose. I suppose if we were trying to make sounds with our nose, it might sound like that audio sample that we heard. According to marine ecologist Andy Foote, belugas, as opposed to other whales, are known as the canaries of the sea because of the wide range of their vocal calls. So even in the wild, they do make a lot more noises than a lot of other whales. Whales such as killer whales cannot create such a wide range of sounds. Maybe their nasal cavities are a different shape or something. Which could explain why Shamu at SeaWorld does not say hello to everyone he sees. Or she? He, I think. Really interesting. Cool stuff. Another part of the article said they want to make sure that they're not sure if the animal was actually trying to communicate with the humans. They believe it was just hearing sounds and then repeating the sounds back again, which is a lot like what parrots do instead of actually trying to communicate. Although it would be pretty neat to somehow train. I wonder if you could train a whale to communicate back. That would be pretty neat. Just to hear what he has to say. I don't even know how you'd teach that. Teach it as in like, so it understands that it is talking to a human and it is trying to say something about something. I guess you'd need quite a bit of self-awareness and things like that. I wonder. Who knows what the future will bring? All right. I'm going to do another song. The next Massachusetts band on the docket today is Aerosmith. I got to say, I had no idea Aerosmith was originally from Boston. Until I started doing research for this show, which is, yeah, shame on me. Probably the biggest band ever to come out of Boston, and I had no idea that Aerosmith was from there. They have so many classics, too, and I think their stuff in recent years has kind of fallen a bit, but they have quite a lot of awesome, amazing songs from, go way back to the 70s. It's hard to choose, so I just decided to go with one of my favorites, which is Dream On. So enjoy. Everybody's got the dues in life to pay. That was, of course, Dream On by Aerosmith. I don't know who wouldn't know that song. Another band from Boston, which I will never forget for the rest of my life, Aerosmith. All right, I got another bit of positive news this week, this time from the scientific journal Nature Medicine. It seems that the HIV virus, which causes AIDS, changes as it affects someone's body. Meaning antibodies created by the immune system at the initial infection, when you first get it, that work against the virus stop working as time passes and become less effective. This is why HIV and AIDS are so hard to eradicate. This was a fairly complicated article, so I hope I understood it fully and can explain it here in a way that actually makes sense. Send me a note if you're confused. So when someone is initially infected with HIV, the body releases a deluge of antibodies that move in to attack it. In response, the virus changes its outside shell. So the cell walls are a change, which means it effectively evades detection and it continues to infect the person's body while now hidden from this first line of defense. So it's almost the way these cells work is that the antibodies created by your immune system will go in and try to attack the virus cells, and then the virus changes how it looks to on the outside, and so your antibodies don't see it anymore. It goes by the shape, and when the shape changes, your immune system, the shape of the virus changes, your immune system loses it. It's almost like a cloaking mechanism. Scientists have said that HIV is an especially difficult virus to create a vaccine for just because of this rapidly changing genome and altered outer appearance. HIV is, I believe, not the only virus that does this. However, sometimes a person's immune system releases antibodies that actually work when attacking HIV for a wide range of the possible changes it goes through, meaning it can't hide and keep infecting the person. The paper released on Sunday, just a few days ago, outlines this particular antibody, which holds great potential for use in an AIDS vaccine. It appeared that in some cases, about a third of infections, if I read the article correctly, the changes that HIV goes through are predictable and always end in a certain specific, always end with a certain specific outer shell pattern. So you could even have two different people who have the HIV virus in front of you, and the way the virus evolves and changes in each individual person may be different. But scientists discovered that in about a third of these, again, if I read this correctly, the changes are the same every time. Penny Moore, a scientist at South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases of the National Health Laboratory Service, that must have quite an acronym, who is studying this, said, and I quote, This is the first time we've really understood that viral evolution itself shapes the antibodies that come out. Being able to work out the pattern of viral evolution will help us think about designing vaccines. One possible end quote. One possible strategy then for combating HIV is to give the patient a sequence of vaccines specifically targeted to the form that the virus is currently taking. Since they know that the virus starts one certain way when it gets in someone's body, then it changes to one thing, then it changes to another thing, then it goes to this final thing, and I'm just making this up. It may not be four steps. If you know how it's going to change, you can give that person the right vaccine for each change. And then by the time you get to the end, you have effectively taken the disease out. This research is incredibly exciting, and if I'm not mistaken, it might have uses for combating other viruses besides HIV, and that's just me thinking. I could be wrong about that, but it seems to me that something like this would have pretty big consequences for fighting other viruses that might change over time as they are infecting you and as they're being attacked by your immune system. Really, it's that your immune system just can't keep up. And by the time the virus gets to its final stage, your immune system is too weak or is just unable to create any more antibodies against it. So speaking of vaccines, I just got my flu shot last night, and you should too. The more people who get vaccinated, the less likely anybody, including those who don't get vaccinated, is going to get the flu. That's how vaccines work. It's called herd immunity. The more people that get vaccinated, the fewer will get sick. That is just a fact. It's the way these things work. Last winter, this is the first year I've actually gotten a flu shot. Last winter, I got incredibly sick. I think it was around December 24th. I started to feel something that night, and then the next day I woke up and I was just dead. I was sick, horribly sick, for at least a week after that. I then coughed for the next about month and a half. I ended up going to the doctor. It was absolutely horrible sickness. One of the worst sicknesses I've had in years, probably since I was a teenager, I'd say. It was a really terrible flu, in essence, is what I'm trying to say to you. And I was in bed. I closed all the shades. I just needed darkness. I couldn't do anything. And at the end of that, I said, that's it. No more of this for me. I'm getting a flu shot every year from now on. And so last night I took my own advice and did that. And I'm glad I did. It didn't even hurt. Hardly felt it. All right. Now it's time for another Massachusetts band, and I got to stick to Boston again. And this time, yes, I am playing a song by the band that goes by the name Boston. They don't just call themselves that. That is, in fact, where they formed and where they came from. I couldn't play any songs from Massachusetts band and skip the band that's named after the capital of this wonderful state. So here's a favorite song of mine by them. It's called Peace of Mind.
Thank you.
That was Peace of Mind by Boston, although I'm sure everybody knows that song. So, astronomy. I need to make this a regular bit here on Unsound Methods. It could be Unsound Astronomy. Too close to the awesome Bad Astronomy with Phil Plate. Great blog, by the way. Also fun to follow on Twitter. Phil Plate, he's a great guy. Or maybe Astronomy Methods. That sounds kind of like a textbook, actually. Yeah, I'll figure it out. Did you know that Uranus actually rotates on its side? None of the planets rotate perfectly with their axes of rotation going straight up and down. Like a top, maybe, when you first spin it, straight up and down. Jupiter is pretty close. It's only angled 3 degrees off of center. Mars and Earth are both tilted at 23 degrees. Venus is actually upside down. It is tilted so far that it rotates backwards, which is like a 180-degree tilt. It's crazy. But Uranus is a weird one in the solar system. It's unique in that it is tilted at 98 degrees. It's basically like if the solar system were on a table, Uranus would be rolling along just like a ball rolling across the table, whereas all the other planets would be, well, give or take, they'd be rotating like a top or a, you know, if you spin a basketball and put on your fingers, spinning like that. But Uranus is rolling instead of spinning. The amazing part is about all this is that nobody knows why. Why is Uranus rolling and all the other planets are spinning? The original idea was that it was hit by something large, like a planet-sized object, very early in its formation when the solar system was first was still being formed. And then then this large object that hit it pushed it over on its side, where it still is to this day. The problem with that hypothesis is that its moon's orbits are also completely tilted and aligned with Uranus, with the Uranus equator, and it's difficult to explain why that would be. If Uranus was hit by one large object and then like tilted right over, its moons, which possibly formed later, wouldn't be that way. They would still be rotating normal along the plane of the rest of the solar system, like a lot of, well, at least close to it, like a lot of the other moons. But not only does Uranus rotate like as if it's rolling, but all the moons that go around are also rotated, are also tilted by the same amount. And that is weird. So a team of astronomers have recently come up with a new idea. I believe it came out a week or two ago. They say Uranus was hit by two smaller objects instead of one large one. The first object would have hit the planet as it was still forming very early in its lifetime, which would have sent a huge plume of debris from the planet into orbit going around it, which would have made sort of a torus or like a donut shape mass of debris flying around the planet, in some cases forms into a moon. That's one of the ideas for how Earth's moon was formed. But before the debris could form into a disk and then moons, which I just explained, a second object smashed into the planet, finishing the deal and pushing it all the way sideways. So one did it a little bit and sent all the stuff into orbit around Uranus, and then the second one hit it again, possibly pushed a little more stuff into orbit around Uranus, and then tilted the planet farther along. And then tidal forces due to gravity from Uranus would have pulled the cloud of debris into the same tilt, after which it would form into a disk, the rings that are currently around Uranus, which are also tilted, and the moons that we see today. If there was only one big collision by a planet-sized object, then the moons going around Uranus would be rotating differently. This two smaller object hypothesis explains both the tilt and the orbit of the moons. Let's see. It still may be incorrect. It is definitely still a hypothesis. It can't be. It hasn't been proven yet, but it's a little bit closer. It's a little closer to a real understanding of this very unusual planet, now the second to last planet in the solar system behind Neptune. Just to mention one of the other ideas for how the tilt happened. Some have said that in its early days, Uranus had one huge moon with a weird orbit that actually pulled on Uranus as it went around, eventually giving it its current crazy tilt. The moon would have been ejected out of the solar system, possibly because of its weird orbit, and that's why it's not around anymore, why we don't see it anymore. More research is needed. Here again, I will plea to the U.S. government to give NASA more money. We need more astronomy research. This stuff, it doesn't just help us learn more about space. It really helps just technology, everything. Space research is huge. And if you didn't know, Earth's own moon is actually pulling on the Earth. It's making the Earth slow down. So and I heard this on a podcast over the weekend, is that the Earth's rotation is slowing down, and it's because of the moon. The moon is also getting farther away, faster than you might think. But the Earth's rotation is slowing down, so days are getting longer. There will be a time when a day is more than 24 hours, maybe 25 or 26. That is in our future. It's a fact. It's just going really slow. It'll be millions of years. All right, my next song is a little bit of a heavier one. It turns out that Rob Zombie, actually, is originally from Haverhill, Massachusetts. This is a multi-talented guy who's had his hands in music, directing, producing, and screenwriting. Pretty much everything he does is heavy and or horror-themed. You know what it makes me think of is like Dracula getting into a hot rod car with the engine sticking out of the front. All right, which is what a Dracula is, and that is the name of this song. Here's Rob Zombie with Dracula.
I am the one. die.
That was Rob Zombie with his song Dragula, a local from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Well, maybe not too local, but it is Massachusetts anyway. All right. I'd like to thank you for listening to Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio at Hampshire College. I am Damon Blanchett. If you'd like to contact me, you can find me on Twitter at Damon Blanchett or on Facebook, or by email at damonbla@gmail.com. Thank you very much again. My last band from Massachusetts this week is All That Remains, another heavier band, very heavy, who are in fact originally from Springfield, very close to where I am sitting right now here at Hampshire. Here is their song, Chiron. This song is in fact very fun to play. In the video game Rock Band, which is where I actually originally heard this song. Fun to play, very difficult to play. Give a listen to the guitar in this song. And that's going to do it for me this week. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll talk to you next week.